Digital 410 Media proudly presents the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast with your hosts, Don Abernathy, Jeff Copsetta, and Dennis Blocker.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast, your favorite World War II-based podcast, and we are back after, well, a crazy weekend, to say the least. Jeff is still on an extended family vacation slash homework trip. He's doing something very, very cool, as he always does. Apparently, Texas is the place for cool. I can't, forgive me, I just ran 2.5 miles. I'm tired, but I can't talk. But apparently, Texas is the down front place for all the cool World War II based shit that goes on in the world, because nothing happens down here in Florida, not since, sadly, the last of the,
World War II vets started passing away, right?
Yeah, no, we had down here, we had the Doolittle Raiders. Woo! Yeah. I got to get my mind right. We had the Doolittle Raiders down here, and six of my close Florida-based World War II reenactors, the guys with the Florida Flyboys, who I did the Memphis Belle photo shoot with, they were the kind of unofficial go-to living history group for the reunion each year. And they were there for like the last 3 years, and they were there the last year when it was down to like 3 or 4 survivors, and they acknowledged that this was the last year. And before that happened, they were explaining to me kind of the cool tradition when they got together is they had a goblet or a wine glass, I guess, representing each member of all the crews, and they would all, you know, all the survivors would be in the area, and they would talking about the Doolittle raids and the, you know, kind of fact it was kind of a almost a accepted suicide mission, or at least a one-way mission. You knew that much. The suicide part would be whether or not you got across enemy lines into quote-unquote friendly territory, or if you're going to risk getting shot down and dealing with prison camps. But they would tell the stories and have the whole weekend, and at the end of the weekend they would have a toast. Well, sadly, you know, each year more and more empty goblets or glasses were left on the table as each survivor passed away. And I guess that last year there's only the whole chest was full and there was only 3 guys, and they were getting, you know, where travel was hard, and so they accepted, hey, this is our last year. But it was one of those situations where they had great backing from a great organization, and you see this every once in a while where they will bring reenactors in at their expense, meaning, you know, it's accepted where reenactors come out to an event. Obviously, we don't pay to be there. We're not getting paid to be there. Usually, the agreement is, hey, we'll schlep all our stuff here. We'll set up. We'll be here for the week, and you guys just provide some food and a place to, you know, hard ground to sleep on. And that's,
yeah, for sure.
That's usually the relationship.
Yeah.
But every once in a while, like in the case of this where it was a big thing, they actually put them up in hotel rooms and, like, took care of their entire weekend. And so, because it was important to them as the organizers to have that visual representation standing, you know, up in the background for people kind of while listening to these men talk, kind of seeing a visual representation of what they would have looked like to kind of give them that, you know, almost you're a fly on the wall type feeling.
Sure.
And so that those things, you know, they happen occasionally, but yeah, it's apparently, yeah, though,
speaking of,
back
to
the topic,
Raiders.
I guess a lot of the stuff, it seems like every other weekend Jeff's doing something cool with somebody that has something to do with some sort of organization or like group, and it's always in Texas. It's not like he's flying to California one weekend or going to New York State or going to Louisiana. He's not a, you know, a continental jet setter or, you know, hopping in a family truckster and making these road trips. No, they just all seem to happen within 2 to 3 hours of his house, so that's very cool. He's definitely spreading the word for the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Absolutely. And there's something really cool he's doing next weekend that we'll let him tell about at another time. But, you know, speaking of Doolittle Raiders, my gosh, at the Tex Hill Wing here in San Antonio, man, one of my favorite all-time memories is going there and seeing they had a Doolittle reunion here in town. And they had 4 B-25s come into Stinson Airfield.
Wow.
And I remember being there, and I'm so thankful because I took my nephew and niece, and the sun was setting, and to see those 4 B-25s come in formation and circle over the airfield and then come in, one drops off, comes into land, the second one drops off. It was just like, oh, man, talk about Goosebump City. And then they all park nose to nose on the flight line. And then we all got to go in to the hangar and meet all Doolittle Raiders and get autographs and pictures. And just tremendous opportunity. I'm so glad that we did it.
What was the one they jumped from? The B-17 was the bomber. The B-24 was also a bomber. Which one did the airborne jump from?
C-47.
Yeah, C-47. I don't know why I can't remember that. One of the cooler things, this was, gosh, probably 6 or 7 years ago. I was at an air show where they had C-47. I don't know why I'm getting hung up on that, but yeah, they had C-47 there parked on the tarmac, and we got to bivouac our camps and along the grass next to the runway, which at night and in the morning when you wake up and you flip open your tent flaps and you're staring down these planes and you're in uniform, that is very cool. Sadly, that time only lasts so long. Then the rest of the day is you're sitting next to a hot tarmac in the middle of July in Florida with F-14s and F-16s screaming overhead. It's like, yeah, can we just go back to what it was 6 o'clock this morning when no one was here? I just woke up in my tent and opened my flaps. I'm staring. I think I have a picture somewhere. I'll have to track it down where I just opened my flaps. I'm like, this is the coolest shit ever. Click.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
But yeah. Real quick, you know, we're the little podcast that could. You know, we've been around 5-6 years now. We don't do any advertising yet. We're going to start doing some here soon, but we're slowly making some traction to the point now where we've actually, instead of tracking down guests, we've had publishers reach out to us and book their authors on our show. I know Jeff gets a lot of emails from people. Henry would get a lot of emails. And I, too, am getting emails, and I'm getting emails from guests we've had on the show that we're starting a relationship with, and one of them is a very prominent World War II based author who reaches out to me occasionally, which still blows my mind. I don't want to let the cat out of the bag yet because I haven't received it, but he's in communication with this particular author, and he's agreed to autograph a book and donate it to us to use as the next Patreon giveaway. We're going to announce that once I have it in hand and make sure the mail lady didn't lose it, and we can start doing photo shoots with it to promote the show and promote the podcast. And so if you guys have been listening and you missed the last few giveaways and you have yet to sign up for Patreon, please head over to WTSPWorldWar2.com, click on the Patreon link, sign up and subscribe. As you know, if you're a longtime listener, we have 3 plans. All you got to do is sign up for any of them, including the $1, $1.50 a month. I can't remember. I think it might be $1.50. It's whatever the lowest amount of money Patreon would allow me to set a rate at is what it is. I think it's maybe $1.50 a month. All you got to do is sign up for any of those 3 plans, and you're registered. And long as you are an active registered Patreon member and your subscription is up to date, meaning you didn't forget to change your debit card and your account's been declined because you got an expired debit card on there. As long as you're up to date and you're active member, your name goes in the drawing, and as we've done before, we'll just one of us will be in the hot seat, if you will, because there's nothing worse than being the one who picks the name, because then everybody's mad at you for not picking their name. So last time Dennis did it, and time before that Jeff did it. I think it might be my time, or I might have the kid do it. But anyhow, sign up, subscribe, it goes a long way to support what we're doing, and you get access to cool stuff. And while you're at it, if you haven't done so, head over to youtube.com, look for D410 Media. As you guys know from listening to the audio version of the show, we just had a Scott Gibson on. Great, great stories. There was a few minutes there where he was borderlining on getting kind of emotional thinking about his feelings towards being on it. And you could see it in his face and you could hear it. And the full video version of that podcast is up on YouTube, but you guys can't see it and can't watch it. It's not there. It's a mystery. However, if you're a Patreon member, you have access to the full video. But with that being said, I did cut 2 small clips, put them up on YouTube. Everyone can see them. So head over to youtube.com, look for D410 Media. Go to our playlist for What's the Scuttlebutt. You can see that. We're working on more videos to get up there as well. Basically, I got a backlog of videos, and there's just not enough time in the day. So we're just kind of putting them up there as time comes. But head over there, and you can get access to that as well. And I'm just trying to get all the housekeeping stuff out of the way. Do YouTube check. Oh, hats and shirts. We're really bad at self-promotion here. I mean, I might mention our shirts once in a while. Whenever you see the videos, we have one. We have hats too. And I know Jeff just ordered a couple to try to maybe give away at this cool event he has coming up. I already have a What's the Scuttlebutt hat. They're great hats, but we have hats, we have t-shirts. So head over to WTSP World War II, get yourself a hat or a shirt. That also, you know, that's more of a our version of advertising because there's no money to be made off of that. Once again.
Yeah, for sure.
One of the things we suffer here at the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast, me, Jeff, and Dennis, we're all the same. And that is we don't feel comfortable charging people stuff that we wouldn't be willing to pay ourselves. And so when I come up with these prices on these t-shirts, the website, I'm like, hey, sell this t-shirt for $37. I'm like, no, I wouldn't buy a $37 t-shirt. So I mark them down once again as low as the website will allow me because the shirt's paid for by them. The ink's paid for by them. Basically, I set my price. You guys order it, and then I make what they just send the profit to my PayPal. And so at these outrageous prices, I stand to make $12 a shirt. I'm like knocking it down to like, what can I, you know, what would I be willing to pay for a shirt? So by the time it's all said and done, I think I make $4 per shirt. So we're not doing this to finance. We're just doing it to kind of as a way of advertising to spread the word. So just head over to WTSPWorldWar2.com. And by the way, if you look at the top, there are coupon codes. So even that $4, we're not even worried about that. We're, you know, the coupon codes are there. We just want people to enjoy the shirts, enjoy the hats, kind of spread the word that way. It's kind of old school rock band, punk band, guerrilla marketing type stuff. So yeah, those are ways cool. You guys can help support the show. And speaking of supporting the show, another thing Dennis is bad at is self-promotion. We're always having authors on here promoting their books, promoting their wares, telling people to go buy their stuff. And we all know Dennis he helped work on a book that, you know, his name's not really on because of the way the industry works. But you do have a book that your name is on that you've posted on Facebook, but I don't think we've talked too much about it on here. It's not World War II based, but it is based on your life and your experiences. So let's share some of that with our audience real quick.
Sure. Yeah. Thank you. It's called Clear, CLEAR, all caps with an exclamation mark. And it's on Amazon. It's about my 23 years in EMS, ER, emergency room. I was a medic, EMT for a short while, and then ER tech, trauma tech on a trauma team, level one trauma for 12 years, and then emergency room for another 11. So altogether, 23 years working emergency medicine in San Antonio. Our particular trauma center was responsible for all of South Texas. So it's almost 25 counties. And that would include all the gangland stuff, the drug lord stuff, the cross the border. I vividly recall working codes on federal agents. They're all dressed in black with their gear loaded to the hilt with weapons coming in full of bullet holes. CPR in progress on all three guys. They had gone down to Laredo and were doing a joint mission with the Federales, and they got tipped off and they drove up to this place and they were waiting on them and they just all got mowed down. We worked the guys just simply because all of their buddies who were all armed were in the hallways looking at us. But when we saw them, we already knew they were dead. But we went ahead and worked them because of their buddies. And we knew they would not tolerate us pulling the plug as soon as they walked in the door. So we gave it a good college try, and that they had exsanguinated long before they got to us by air. Just kind of an example of that.
I just want to pause on that real quick. I don't want to over jump that because of recent events. When you're in a situation like that and you're the caregiver, the trauma giver, the person that people around you are looking at to hopefully make this situation turn out in a positive light, but reality's there, you're trained, you've seen it, you know the reality's there. Do you find in your experience, not only is it a kind of your job or mission or responsibility to, as you were saying, you know that it's too late, but you got to put forth the effort. Do you think seeing that effort get put forth maybe helps the family members of the victims kind of cope better than just, you know,
for sure,
them showing up and for sorry, sure.
It's absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely, Don. And that comes with experience after doing it for a while. All of us veteran guys that had been doing it a while, the guys and gals, because I was showing my daughters the other day, we were in the garage cleaning out some bins, and I showed them a card from a family, from a person who had died, and they sent a card to our director and specifically to give to me. And it was thanking me for, because the family was in the hallway. And something that we also would do, Don, is we would have families come in and watch us work. And as long as it wasn't a bloody scene and all that, if it was like CPR in progress, cardiac arrest or something like that, we would bring them in so they could see all the effort that was done. That they would see the drugs that were administered, the CPR, the Lucas machine that was working. They would see all the medications that were administered, the cardioversion that was attempted, all of the teamwork of everybody, how cool, calm, and collective everybody was. It was not loud. It was a very cool, very quiet code because everybody knows what the heck they're doing and they already preemptively think of things before having to be told. And they would see that and quietly sit off to the background, and we would always assign a nurse to stand with them. And the nurse would just quietly lean over and whisper, like give them little updates on, well, this is what they're doing now and this is why they're doing that. And we got so much positive feedback from that. And in particular, this card I mentioned, the family said, thank you so much for taking the time. We know you were busy, but we watched as you, after they called the code and they pronounced my mother dead, we watched as you went in and wiped the blood off of her face. You changed her sheets. You brushed her hair. You put new linen on there. You tucked her in as if she was still alive. And she's like, you'll never know how much that meant to our family. So even that kind of thing, Don, really means a lot to people. And it's a step above when you're fortunate like I was to have the amazing nurses and medics that trained me who were, you know, mindful of that. And that was just, man, tremendous.
Well, the reason I'm bringing it up, the reason I said since recent events, one of the things I heard from the Trump rally shooting was the retired fire chief, the gentleman who passed away on site. What I heard was in the audience was a trauma technician or a trauma ER doctor. And he basically said what you said. Was, I walked over, saw his head, knew that it was what it was, but we proceeded to cover his head up with the towel and go through the procedure of CPR and the resuscitation process. And he kind of hinted around more for the people around us than, for you know, sure. Cause I mean, especially in that situation, could you imagine if the people in the audience just saw the body laying there and no one was trying to do anything?
Yeah. They wouldn't understand.
Yeah.
That's a very mature call to make. That shows someone who is, that is somebody I would want taking care of my family, because they put in that extra effort to also be mindful of what's going on around them. That is exceptional to be able to do that. But my book goes into my time in the ER, and then it also goes into the darkness that comes when you see a lot of, because, you know, we're down here and all the drug trafficking and human trafficking and all that, and we would see all of the torture, folks coming up short on drug money, and they get tortured for 3 months and they escape and they've been burned, and every inch of their body has marks and lacerations and puncture holes from screwdrivers and hot plate burns on their butt cheeks, and they escape, and then we're taking care of them, and you're hearing these stories from them, and you see the fear in this young girl's face. And I remember that I was leaving and she just screamed. And she just grabbed my arm and dug her nails into my skin and please don't leave me alone in here. Please don't leave me alone in here. And so I said, okay, yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. I'll stay with you. Don't worry. I'm here. You're safe. You're safe. And, you know, you see that, Don, you see that. You look into the eyes of a child who has just been abused and burned. And, you know, you start to get some darkness. And my book talks about that as well.
Put a relatable thing on that. When people hear stories like that or see it firsthand, one of the things, you know, like when you're explaining that, one of the things that jumps to my mind is like, these are things that people need to hear and need to see, because if we saw them and heard them, more people would probably expect more to be done to help prevent these situations from occurring. Absolutely. But with that being said, so much of this happens. How would you responsibly do that in a way that we could make people aware, but not, because you know from firsthand, but without traumatizing the public? Because there's a lot of times, you know, once again, with the, what happened over the weekend, and we're not getting into politics of this. It's history. This is a history podcast. I never served in the military, but through my interactions and doing World War II living history for so long, a lot of my fellow historians are veterans, service members, and a lot of them are combat veterans. And combat veterans, they see things in a different light depending on what they've done. And someone sent me an unsolicited, unedited shot, a picture that the SWAT team took of the shooter after they shot him. And it was all as you think it would be. And I showed it to Carrie, and she's like, wow, that's gory. I'm like, well, that's the shooter. And she looked at it, and she said, everybody should see that. It's horrible. Everybody should see that. But if maybe people saw that, they would see what the consequences of making those type of decisions were. And wow, that would go with preventing. And your first instinct is, yeah, they should put that on TV. They should put that on the internet. But then you're like, I don't want my 12-year-old to see that shit. I don't want my 50. And so it's like, there's a lot of times when horrible things happen that have a horrible result. And sometimes you angrily, you're like, well, if everybody saw that result, they wouldn't do it. But then you're like, well, how do we do that responsibly without traumatizing society? Or maybe at this point, do we need the traumatization?
Yeah. Yeah. There's a fine line there. I really believe, I think as long as you're able to process it correctly, but you have people to guide you along. You know, that was probably part of the main reason that I had such terrible PTSD was that we weren't briefed on how to process what we were seeing, you know, and we're empathetic. So it just creates this turmoil inside you because you're putting yourself in their shoes. You know, I remember a dad who they were on their way. He, his wife, kindergartner and their 9-month old baby were on their way to his mom's house for Memorial Day. And they got hit head on by a drunk. And on the scene, the guy's wife died on the scene. The 9-month old died on the scene. And his 5-year-old came to us and survived 5 days and passed away. So I was thinking about that guy, like that dad, like, how do you not go home and just pour gasoline through every room in that place and just burn it to the ground? Because I don't know how you, that's just having children, you know, I just don't know how you get from that. And there's some stories about those sorts of circumstances in my book, people that I met that lived on the streets, a guy named Bear, a very similar circumstance. I'll let readers, if they want, read the story, but it's called The Bear, the chapter. And it's about this gentleman who was a company commander in Vietnam, graduate of UCLA, an engineer, 6-figure job, had everything. And then events happen. And the next thing you know, he loses all hope. And he's on the street flying a sign, as they say. And that's why I always tell my sister, my daughters, like, I told them from a very young age, never judge the folks that are on the street corners. You do not know their story. And those kind of stories are in the book. But it's not all just travesty and death and sadness. There's some really hilarious stuff in there. There's also a recipe on how I was able to get out of the darkness. And that's the main thing. And, you know, it's getting really good reviews on Amazon. I think it's still up to 5 stars and getting medics, nurses, even people that are not medical, but UZRs or the 911, they have sent me emails and letters and saying, this is amazing. And I have a doctor up in San Francisco, Dr. Patricia Bay. She actually prescribes my book to her patients for PTSD. And so if folks want to get a copy, they can get it on Amazon. Or if they want, they can get me on Facebook and instant message me, send me a friend request, instant message me. Venmo me $30 and that will cover postage and I'll sign it and then send it to you. If you want a signed copy with a special message, if you want it for a gift for somebody, maybe you've got a child who's thinking about going into EMS. There's a lot of really good stuff in there that they are going to need to know that I wish I had known. And maybe you've got your family member is currently an RN and they're dealing with some stuff. you know, there's been a lot of good feedback on this book. It's helping a lot of people.
And always, you can, if you're driving in your car or someplace where you don't have the ability to jump on a computer right away, just email us at WTinfo. Actually, no, I'm thinking of the other website. Email us at mailcall@WTSPWorldWar2.com, and I'll forward that directly to Dennis, and he'll get back to you, and he can send you the links and get your request and all that stuff. And once again, that's we'll also have links over at WTSPWorldWar2.com, just like when any other author's on. Dennis is no exception. So when he's on, we'll have a page, and we'll have links to his stuff as well. That's WTSPWorldWar2.com. Real quick, it's going to kind of – the bridge will get there. When I was going to school for computers back in 2002, that's how old I am, I was going in Irvine, California. And there was a gentleman in my class who was in the Marine Corps, and he was getting the same certifications we have. But ironically, he taught this stuff in the Marine Corps. But he was explaining to us that he was getting ready to get out of the Marine Corps, and his Marine Corps certifications, Marine Corps training meant nothing in the civilian world. And so he had to go sit through the class, get certifications for the shit he teaches in the military. I bring that up to say this. When you made your transition from the military and doing the medical stuff based there into the civilian world, what sort of classes or training, what sort of transitional steps did you have to go through to become that ER on the ER trauma crew and things and EMS and all that? Was there a big training difference, or did you have to get some civilian certifications?
No, that's a really, really good question. And what's really awesome is that the military has moved forward on that. And they do have their medics as national certified EMTs. So if they are an EMT in that world, they also are in the outside. But also more than that, though, most emergency departments, if you put on your resume that you have, because let's face it, you're probably going to do 4 years. But I think a requirement is 2. But if you have a service, military service on your resume, and you were a medic, or a corpsman, or a pharmacist mate, or something like that, you're gold. You're good to go. They're looking for that. They're looking for those people that are steady. In our emergency department, we had all the medics were all, they called us the grays. We were all in our 40s. We all had these beards. But we were all, not myself, I was never in combat. But the other guys were all combat veterans. And my combat was, you know, working in the trauma center and wrestling weapons and guns from people and knives. But the other guys were these combat vets, Afghanistan, Iraq, we were the grays, and the nurses were all in their 20s, and they're exceptional and smart and witty and sharp and young and beautiful and just amazing. And then here's the medics, and you know, we're these grizzled grays. And it was a tremendous time, because we were very protective of our nurses, and they in turn were very protective of us. As far as if the nurses got something for Nurses Week, they always made sure the medics also got it from the hospital.
It's funny. I saw a TikTok not too long ago of a girl in her 30s. She's like, to all the girls who did X, Y, and Z in school, how do you like being an RN, and how's your cop boyfriend? How's your fireman boyfriend? Basically making those kind of jokes, but. What was I going to say? Back to what you were describing earlier with your book, do you think that trauma response, personal trauma response, personal mental health, tools, do you think that should be kind of a point of study in the civilian or even military training curriculum for becoming, a trauma specialist or response personnel or even an EMT in the civilian world? You know, you're talking about all the horrible things you guys see, but and maybe they do. Is there any sort of like, or maybe they need to include it in the training? Hey, you guys are going to start to witness X, Y, and Z. When you start to notice these sort of feelings or thoughts, you should reach out here, here, and here. Or do they really not cover any of that as far as you know?
No, they don't. Like they're aware of that. That's a problem, but they have a new crop of nurses coming through all the time that are graduating.
Considered an occupational hazard.
And it's a crying shame. And it's the one thing that ticks me off the most, and it makes zero business sense. Why would you not invest in a counselor for that would be on staff where all your people in a, let's just say like university hospital, you had in the ER, you had 200 nursing staff, that to include the medics, the clerks, the nurses, the LVNs, you have all them. Why would you not have a full-time mental health nurse who their whole job is everybody is required to have a 30-minute sit down, you know, every couple months or whatever, you have to have it. Now you go in and if you go in and talk about football the whole time, hey, that's on you, but you have your opportunity and they get to ask you some very poignant questions. Because if I, in 1998, had someone like that able to talk to me about how to deal with Danielle Reynosa, the little two-year-old, whose brains I was washing out of her hair to get her family ready to come view her body. Like if I, and the fact that I still remember her name since 1998, I mean, if someone was there to be able to walk me through this and to say, no, you don't have to hold onto the stuck point of she died too young, right? Or the stuck point of if she had her seatbelt on, she would have survived. Or the stuck point of she should have had a full life, right? Well, then a counselor in 2020 was able to tell me, where did you learn this concept that life is fair? Right. Mm-hmm. I was like, right. That was a hard stop. And it was like, how do you know that she was going to have a full life? How do you know that the next week she wasn't going to get hit by a car walking across the street? How do you know she wasn't going to get leukemia or bone cancer? How, blah, 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 blah. And it, one by one, all of these quote unquote stuck points, she called them, that I had been holding on to began to fall off my shoulders. And I began to get my smile back because, but just imagine if I had somebody in 1998 and not 2020 freaking tell me. And to your point about mental health for those that are there, why would they not invest in that? Because then you get to keep all your veterans, right? And you have the new ones come on, sure, because some people are going to retire, but you have all that experience that's there and they stay. But no, what we call it? We call it burnout.
Well, that's all what I was going to say. PTSD. That's what I was going to say. Even if we look at it from the evil lens of the movie version of the evil corporations, if you look, even if you're looking at it like sterilely and numerically, just by offering that service, you're going to hopefully the people who participate in it willingly will A, get the help they need, B, miss, as you were just saying, get rid of the burnout, and you'll have longevity. And so now you're getting your corporate investment out of the personnel you've already invested in, because now they're taking less personal time off. They're taking, you know, less 3-week vacations, or they don't just get up and quit. And now you got to fill a position, start their training. And so the money spent on the payroll of that one or two personal, you know, that personnel to provide that mental health, that salary is negated in lost revenue and training and people getting burnt out. It in the long sterile corporate world, it would make up for itself in the end.
Absolutely.
It would more than pay for itself.
Absolutely. And also mistakes that new nurses make. You eliminate that because you've got the experienced nurses there. And then even when you do have new nurses, the experienced nurses looking over their shoulder saying and whispering in their ear, no, don't do that.
Or the mistakes that you get from just being burnt out on doing something.
Right. So yeah, absolutely. And I know that, you know, we're supposed to have a debrief after every code. And we had one debrief in all the years I was there, because let's face it, man, there's 70 people in the waiting room. Yeah. There's people are angry in the front. How much longer is it going to be? Like we don't have time for a sit down, hold hands and kumbaya about
and
this,
not only
right?
that, but could you imagine working a 12-hour shift and they say, okay, hold tight. We need another 3.5 hours to debrief the 70 cases you looked at. I'm good. I'd rather go home. We'll deal with it.
So there has to be somebody designated that you have to go, and it's a requirement. It would be a requirement in my book. It would have to be required, because you have those tough guys like myself that they don't want to look weak in front of other people by going to see the counselor. But if everybody has to go for a certain amount of time, then whether you talk about football or you just walk in and say I'm fine and then you walk out, but you have to sign off, man. You have to sign off. You have to go in there. And it's just too dangerous, man, because I know a couple nurses and medics that killed themselves, and I was almost there myself at one point, and I know how dark it can get. You just have so many nightmares day after day. You're not resting. You get tired. You get wore down. And it does make sense when you look at the parking garage and you think, man, if I just stepped off that thing, I'll finally be able to get some rest. And it sounds legit. And it's scary because it does sound legit and it kind of makes sense. And some people do. They pull the trigger or they, you know, overdose on something or.
Well, it's interesting how trauma on all scales affects people and as it works. You know, when we're all younger, you know, bravado, especially dudes, you know, bravado kicks in. And, you know, I graduated in 97 and right around that time, it's when, you know, 95 through 2004, that's when the school shootings started happening more and more, and you'd see it on the news. And you'd always hear, oh, we're going to have psychologists on, you know, at school on Monday for the survivors who are traumatized. And at 19, 20, you're bravado, like, well, traumatized for what? You know, blah, 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 blah. It's crazy how even just hearing something and not visually witnessing it can affect you. And let me just give you a little personal experience because, you know, that's what we live based off of. About 10 years ago now, I lived on the other side of the neighborhood. I bought my house and I was renting a house. And I think I binge watched most of the episodes of season 2 of Peaky Blinders. Now, you know how, like, if you play video games all day long, you go to sleep, you dream about the video games, right? And then you wake up tired. Or if you're working a lot, you go to sleep. Like, when I worked at Horton building ambulances, I don't know if I ever told you, I built ambulances for 3 years. When I was working at Horton emergency vehicles, just 55 hours a week building ambulances, there'd be times I was dreaming about wiring up ambulances, and I'd wake up exhausted. So I binge-watched Peaky Blinders season 2, and I went to bed, and then I heard pop, pop. I woke up. We had a beagle. Beagle wasn't barking. Carrie wasn't awake. I didn't have glasses at the time. I didn't have my contacts in, but I looked out the window. I didn't hear any cars screeching. I didn't hear anybody screaming. I'm like, it sounded like a 38. I'm like, well, I just watched the entire season of people getting shot on Peaky Blinders. Maybe I'm dreaming it. It was like midnight. Went back to bed. Hour and a half later, cops are knocking on my door. Did you hear anything? Yeah, I heard about an hour ago what I thought was a 38, but explaining to them I didn't hear anything. Everything, I just went over. Turns out, across the street from me, there was two vacant lots, and then the third lot down was a rental property. Unbeknownst to me, because the guy didn't, he wasn't like a weed dealer where like people were sitting in his driveway for 15 minutes at a time doing the 15-minute rule. Apparently, this guy was like a storage unit for large transfers of fucking weed. And somebody found out about it. And they came over to rob him. They ended up shooting him in his front yard with a .22 long rifle. Bled out in the living room. I didn't think anything about it, right? I heard it. Went back to sleep. Woke up next day. The news is parked out from my house, whatever. Just never. We didn't talk about it. I was running radio at the time. And on the newspaper, there's like their house and the police tapes wrapped around my mailbox. So I didn't want to bring it up on the show because I didn't want people to know where my address was. Know where I lived. And I didn't think about it. Well, that happened like on a Saturday or Sunday, right? That Friday was my first time working with World War II armor up in Central Florida with Rabbi Rob and all their tanks and all that, 50 cals. And we're full pack. We're going out there training. And I'll tell you what, every time I heard a gunshot, I've been reenacting for years. I got nervous. For the following next 3 weeks, driving down the street, heard any loud bang. Once again, that night, just some gunshots. Just hearing it in my sleep and then knowing what happened produced signs of PTSD with me jumping, me getting nervous when I'm hearing gunshots. Then after like 2 months, the anxiety would come. It's like, and then I realized, oh, that's what in the 90s and now when you hear about school shootings and they're saying they're going to have therapists for the survivors, that's what it is. Because even though in real life you only experience the faint sound, but the trauma around it, especially at that level for them, I can only imagine. I mean, if I'm getting that much anxiety just from hearing, knowing my neighbor got shot, I couldn't even remotely imagine what those kids are going through, living through that in real life. But it's, I guess what I'm getting to is people don't realize until it actually happens to you, especially when you're younger, like I said, the bravado, that wouldn't affect me none. Bullshit. You will never know how things will affect you until it actually does. And so kind of to Dennis's point, someone who's lived through it, and maybe that's part of the problem, right? A lot of times the people in charge of putting these sort of policies or these procedures in place to vote them in or financing them or decide whether it's financially feasible. Maybe if more people who actually lived through those experiences were put on those boards to help make those decisions versus somebody who's never experienced it, so they don't understand why those things need to be put in place, maybe there'd be a change in the system too. Because you don't know how things affect people until you've experienced it at any sort of level. Then you realize,
that's right.
And then, much like anything in life, right? The older you get, the more things you experience, more experiences, the more you understand and can relate with people versus, and we see it, you see it all the time, right? Someone who grew up living in the same small town, who never left, grew up around the same people they grew up with, they might have a more hard, narrow scope when it comes to ideology or worldview versus someone who's enlisted in the military or went off to college or maybe, you know, traveled around the world or lived in four or five states and, you know, in the country and has actually lived in different communities, lived in different environments, and you get the experiences of what it's life like being in different places, you're going to have a more wide worldview versus someone who's only experienced that small little thing.
Yeah, I agree. You know, but I used to think that maybe, you know what, it's funny, is like every generation, they always think that the generations before or after are weaker. And looking at newspapers from the 40s, you know, you'd see the older people, I don't know if our generation are going to be able to fight. You know, they've been at it pretty easy. They've been listening to big band music and skating and going to the soda jerks and, you know, this and that and going to the movies.
Wearing them damn high-waisted pants with the pinstripes.
Right. Hot rods and zoot suits and, you know, and I don't know if they're going to have what it takes. And, you know, they stepped up and they handled it. And, you know, the same was said for, you know, my generation. Right. And, you know, they went to Afghanistan and Iraq and they handled business. And, you know, I think that when it comes down to it, America was settled by some of the most badass people on the planet, because these are people that had to have the courage to leave everything behind and head off to the unknown. And they were going to go with just the suitcase or a bag over their shoulder and didn't even speak the language. And they're leaving everything behind. And that's some moxie, man. That's some moxie. And those people are the people that settled this country. And that's some pretty good stock. And I don't know. I just feel like, I feel like that when you're in those situations that you tap into some DNA and it surfaces and your ancestors come back and give you a big push to get you through some things. It's pretty awesome.
You know, I was just thinking, talking about those in the past and the moxie, but the thing we also overlook is how damn young. Obviously, we know World War II, they were, you know, 17, 18, but even prior to that, World War I, the founding of our nation. Have you ever seen the list of like the ages of our founding fathers during 1776? People think, you know, they see the pictures because they wear the white wig because that was protocol, right? The Whig Party, they had to wear the white. Those were wigs. So people see those pictures. Oh, it's old white. No. I Googled this. It's been a while since I looked at it. Age of the Revolutionary. How were the early American leaders? I'm sorry. How old were the early American leaders on July 4th, 1776? It's a simple question, perhaps so basic that it's been overlooked. How old were the key participants in the American Revolution? Authors often reveal their age of a particular soldier, participant, and other main characters in books of the Revolution, but I've routinely found myself wondering about their peers at the same time. As it turns out, many founding fathers were less than 40 years old in 1776, with several qualifying as founding teenagers and 20-somethings. Although the average age of the signer of the Declaration of Independence was 44, more than a dozen of them were 35 years or younger. And so here's a list of ages important to the American Revolution characters, seeming elementary enough and certainly easy to assemble, yet it wasn't, I wasn't able to find such a list anywhere. I looked online and I don't recall ever stumbling upon such an appendix while researching my book. So I figured I'd just make one. This is a list of ages from youngest to oldest of key American Revolutionary participants, providing the precise age as of July 4th, 1776. As you spot any corrections or concerns, please email me. Now, keep in mind, you're going to hear some of these names. You're going to hear the age. Like, wait, they're way young, but they're particular. This is how old they were in 1776. Their key role didn't happen until years later. But these are the age in 1776 of our founding fathers and later key members of our building of our country. So in 1776, Andrew Jackson was only 9 years old. Thomas Young was 12. I'm going to skip some of these to people that you may recognize. Peter Salem was 16 years old. James Monroe was 18. Charles Piccinini was 18. Henry Lee III was 20. John Trundle was 20. Aaron Burr was 20 years old. John Marshall was 20. Nathan Hale was 21. Alexander Hamilton was 21. John Warren was 21. Benjamin Talmadge, which you guys may remember from, what was that show, Traitors or whatever? Washington Spies or whatever?
Turn,
Washington Spies. Benjamin Talmadge was 22. Robert Townsend was 22. George Rogers Clark was 23. Betsy Ross was only 24 when she started making those flags. William Washington was 24. James Madison was 25. Skipping a few more. Abraham Woodhull, 26. George Walton was 27. John Paul Jones was 28. Robert Livingston was 29. Benjamin Rush, 30. Skipping. Abigail Adams was only 31. So Thomas Jefferson, 33. Thomas Stone, 33. William Hooper, 34. Skip, skip, skip. There's a whole bunch of them on here. But yeah, just so many of these people, as the opener said, were younger than 45. So some of them were actually, like they're saying, teenagers. And so sometimes you're saying, I'm sure their parents are saying, oh, your generation isn't going to grow up to do nothing. And here they are creating an entire nation out of a ragtag group of rebels who got tired of paying 3.5% taxes on their goods. So you never know.
No. Nope. Never do.
Never do. We got a new segment we're going to do in the future coming up. I'm going to let Dennis kind of give you guys his layout. We're not going to get into the first one, but just kind of set the stage. We're doing a little house cleaning. We're just kind of, decompressing after the week. And Jeff's out doing his adventures. So, just to keep you guys up to speed on what's going on, you got a pretty cool idea for a new segment on the show, right?
Yeah, we were kicking around some ideas. We were smoking a cigar over at Jeff's place up in Burnet and sipping on some whiskey. And we were kicking around ideas for the show. And we thought it'd be kind of cool if we had a segment called The Valor Vault. And it would be one of us will come up with an act of valor or heroism or courage and against the, whatever, and that really stood out. But it would be something that no one knows about. Like, of course, not you wouldn't be able to present Audie Murphy or, something like that, but somebody, some story or some person that really did something heroic. And it doesn't have to be World War II. It could be something else. But of course, we're going to focus on World War II as much as we can. But and we're kicking around the idea of the three of us each having one ready for that segment, and then whoever's is the most valorous or the most interesting would win for that week, and then we'll tally it up at the end or something like that. We haven't really got all the specifics worked out yet.
Yeah, I think we're going to come up with
something that Jeff and I were kicking around, the Valor Vault.
Yeah. I think we're going to come up with like a grading system. Like, you present your story, and then like, if I never heard about it, you get a point. And if Jeff never heard about it, you get 2 points. And then, so you have 2 points on your record. But if I heard that story, you lose a point. You know what I mean? Just to kind of
exactly.
Make it more fun. Now, I think it would make more sense for longevity of this segment to each person present something 1 week. Cause if we do in one episode, we're going to blow through 3 potential weeks in one episode. And if we're telling stories that no one knows, we could potentially burn through those rather quickly if we're presenting all 3 per episode. So I kind of like the idea of one per week. And then, on week 4, we'll kind of do a review and then hand out the grades or something. That'd be kind of cool.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds good.
And then we can have people email us at mail@wtspworldwar2.com, write it up, run it through a chat GPT, and then we'll read it online, and then we'll vote, and say, you know, and then the audience could have, you know, they get the audience would actually have a bonus point, because when the three of us are battling, we only have a potential of earning 2 points. We can't give ourselves a point, but the audience can have a potential of earning 3 points if me, you, and Jeff have never heard of it. So they actually have kind of a step up in the possibility of beating us in a point system. And if we get a lot of those stories, we could even have something on our website where it's us versus, you know, the audience will have a combined score versus us, and, you know, see who wins that way too. But yeah, they could have a potential of winning 3 points per episode if none of the three of us have never heard their stories.
Yeah. And who knows, maybe at the end of a year or whatever, or a certain amount of stories, maybe we could even put a compendium together of the, in the stories, and into a booklet form.
Yeah.
But let's see where that goes. We'll check it out.
And as always, if you guys have anything you want us to talk about, cover, or, you know, more importantly, if you guys, they're still out there and they're very sharp. Their health may not be great. They may not be mobile, but that's what phones are for. And that's what Zoom meetings are for, and technology. If you guys know any living vets who can carry on a conversation, you know, even if I got to edit it down, but, you know, if they're, you know, willing and wanting to talk, we would love to have them on the show, get their story out there, get it in our collection. And we're always looking for vets. I know other people are always looking for vets. There's kind of a behind the scenes communication open. Hey, anybody, you know, come across anybody, you know, anybody out there talking. And so if you guys know, have a grandfather, a great grandfather, a neighbor, you know, email us,
sure.
Mail call at WTSPWorldWar2.com. All we need is a point of contact. We'll handle the rest. You know, somebody we can call who has access to this person. And it don't have to be a war veteran per se. It could be, we've done it in the past where we interviewed women who were at home working on the, you know, home front, holding the family together, maybe working a Rosie Riveter job. So, you know, it doesn't have to be a gentleman in his mid-hundreds. It could be a lady as well. You know, we're willing to talk to anybody
absolutely.
Who was alive during that time, who can kind of give us their perspective and their memories and their thoughts, because these stories are going to be, if not, you know, as time goes by, there's not going to be anybody else to relay them in first-person accounts.
Yep, that's right.
And we want to thank everybody for hanging out with us for this episode. It's a little different episode, but, you know, I feel it's an important one. I wanted Dennis to have the opportunity to discuss his book, because I know he posted something on Facebook. I shared it on our Facebook page, and some people reached out to him. And I'm like, well, we never talk about it on the show. And so that book is called Clear. It's available on Amazon, and you will have a link. Just head over to WTSPWorldWar2.com. Look for this episode, and we'll have links there. And we'll also have a way for you to contact Dennis if you want an autographed copy. Like I said, you can just Venmo him the money and we'll get it sent out to you. Or if you want a gift, as Dennis was saying earlier, he could specialize it for you and get those done. Thank you guys so much. Jeff will be back next week.
Y'all.
We have, he's working on getting a really, really cool guest. Hopefully that comes together. But thank you guys, for myself, Jeff, Dennis. We'll talk to y'all next week.
This has been a Digital 410 production.